Well, I'm always been a guy that's kind of embraced technology, and sometimes technology turns on me. It's one of those days. I've prepared all my notes and stuff on Word, and I was going to had every intention of printing it out before I came here. Of course, the best laid plans of mice and men. I'm not sure who the poet was to pen those words, but you know, I'm going to have to rely on this thing. And I'm really, really hoping that I have at least an hour's worth of battery. Now, I often say this one when I take my turn up here to try to teach the class. You could probably fit everything that I would want to say in 10 minutes. So I really, really want to solicit everybody's participation because, for the obvious reason, it's going to be a very short class if you don't participate. So. And then, given the fact that it's pretty cool, it feels pretty good in here. I like it. Tim, I just really appreciate you sucking up here, wiping that hand with that thing. It's hot. But now, here we are. It's cooled down considerably. Bear with me just a second. This laptop is really not the most portable of things. It's really good. You're kind of leave it home. Now, if I remember correctly, we were what, ready for the questions on Hebrews chapter 9, or did we have some passages that we read? I think we're ready for questions. I'm sorry? Well, I have this sheet of questions that Chuck gave me and said, here, go over these. So I'm going to stick with the blank. And then I'm also ready, once we go through the questions, we can go ahead and start into chapter 10. And you know, I love the book of Hebrews. I love all the books of the Bible, but there's some to me that are a little, I enjoy a little more. I can't help but, you know, I focus on the fact that the writing of Hebrews is somewhere around 64 A.D. And I guess if we asked everybody to boil the book of Hebrews down into a phrase or sentence, we might each have our own take of what it means. But to me, it's the writer's attempt at telling the Hebrews, don't turn back. And, of course, we have, you know, we're looking backwards at history. We know that around 70 A.D., Titus is going to bring a Roman army in there and just turn them over in that place. And I always wonder about, you know, the people who heeded the warning and those who didn't. And, you know, you can make that application across time up to our present day. Those of us who you know, we hear the gospel preached, are we going to heed his warning? So that to me, that's the thesis or the mission statement, whatever you want to call it, in the book of Hebrews. I'm going to go ahead and start the questions that Chuck gave on Hebrews 9. Okay, in Hebrews chapter 9, what was the worldly sanctuary? Tabernacle. That's what I put. Does anybody else have anything different they would add to that? Name the contents of the tabernacle as listed in this chapter.
The lampstand, the table, the showbread, the
candlestick,
the showbread.
Those items were in the first part.
Right.
Okay, and then there's the secondary.
Right.
What would be
the golden censers, the threshold.
Right. What would we find in that area?
Golden jar, man, Aaron rod.
Tablets.
Right, tablets and the cherubim. What did the golden pot contain?
Manna.
Of course, we know that story. That's how God fed the children of Israel as they were wandering in the wilderness. Okay. What did the budding of Aaron's rod signify? I'm not looking for an elaborate, long answer. Basically, as I went back and read the story, it basically indicated that Aaron was the chosen one.
Yeah, they're Lord.
Right. All the 12 tribes, that was his rod that budded. What day and month each year did the high priest enter the most holy place? The answer I have is the seventh month or the tenth day of the month. Does anybody have anything different than that one?
Tenth day of the seventh month, what did you say?
I said the seventh month of the tenth day. Did I get it backwards?
Tenth day of the seventh month.
Okay. Leviticus 16, 49, 34. Okay, I have Leviticus
16. But do I go there?
I don't think I cut and pasted that one, so...
Yeah, Leviticus 16.
This can be part of your 30 minutes, Mark. 16
what?
Leviticus 16:29. And from the statute, the seventh month on the 10th day.
Okay.
So July 10th. It's coming up.
Different calendar.
All right. How long were the ordinances of the old covenant imposed upon man? Now, Hebrews uses an interesting word for that.
Until the new covenant.
Reformation. That's the word that's used in Hebrews, which to me means when Jesus comes on the scene. When Jesus comes.
Well, when he died on the cross.
Right. Well, you're right. Well, I said when Jesus appears on the scene, I meant through the sacrifice on the cross. Yeah, y'all have to bear with me now because my hearing is not the best, and when the background noise, I have a very difficult time hearing what's being said. So please bear with me. Okay, what sort of uncleanness did the ashes of the red heifer purify? Reading that I read on that topic.
Touching a corpse?
Right, that dealt with touching a dead body or coming in contact with a dead body. Okay. In contrast to this, what part of man does the blood of Christ cleanse? Well, the ceremonial purification dealt with the fleshly man. Jesus cleanses the spiritual man. That was my take on it. Okay. And if anybody has anything different, or please feel free to chime in and welcome the discussion. What did Moses sprinkle with blood? I think I skipped one. Okay. When man's conscience is cleansed, what will he then serve? Living God. Anybody have anything different? Okay. I'll take this stone cold silence as an affirmation until somebody says something different. What did Moses sprinkle with blood? What is the meaning of "for then must he often have suffered since the foundation of the world"? What is the meaning of, and in quotes, "for then must he have often suffered since the foundation of the world"? He is referring to Jesus. I think this has to deal with the fact that Jesus' sacrifice was once for all and not continually. And then the last one. What well-known principle does the author use to show that Christ died but once? The way I answered that was the fact that after he died, he went and sat at the right hand of God, and he is now in heaven. That's the way I answered the question. If anybody else has a different answer, you know. Okay, that answers questions on Hebrews chapter 9. So now we'll go ahead and get started in the 10th chapter. And what I'd like to do is read the first 18 verses and then have some points that I'd like to open up for discussion. So, Tim, if you would start us off and read, let's read three verses apiece and just work our way through until we get down to the first 18 verses.
For the law, since it has only a shadow of the good things to come and not the very form of things, can never by the same sacrifices which they offer continually year by year make perfect those who draw near. Otherwise, would they not have ceased to be offered because the worshippers, having once been cleansed, would no longer have been conscious of sins? But in those sacrifices there is a reminder of sins year by year.
For it is not possible that the blood of bulls and goats could take away sins. Therefore, when he came into the world, he said, "Sacrifice and offering you did not desire, but a body you have prepared for me. And burnt offerings and sacrifices for sin you had no pleasure."
Then I said, "Behold." Then I said, "Behold, I have come in the volume of this book. It is written of me to do your will, O God." Previously saying, "Sacrifice and offerings, burnt offerings, and offerings for sin, you do not desire, nor have pleasure in them, which are offered according to the law." Then he said, "Behold, I have come to do your will, O God." He takes away the first that he may establish the second.
By that will, we have been sanctified through the offering of the body of Jesus Christ once and for all. And every priest stands ministering daily and offering repeatedly the same sacrifices which can never take away sins. But this man, after he had offered one sacrifice for sins forever, sat down at the right hand of God.
From that time, waiting until his enemies are made his footstool, for one offering he had perfected forever those who are being sanctified. But the Holy Spirit also witnesses to us, for after he had said it before.
This is the covenant that I will make with them after those days, said the Lord. I will put my laws upon their heart, and upon their mind I will write them. He then says, "In their sins and their lawless deeds I will remember no more. And where there is forgiveness of these things, there is no longer any offering."
I think the first 18 verses, I kind of looked at it as kind of a compare and contrast between Jesus and the law. Now, the law was limited in that the animal sacrifices could not take away sin. God did not have pleasure in the animal sacrifices. Sacrifices had to be made, had to be continually made. And the priest who made those sacrifices first had to sacrifice for themselves. Now, when we look at Jesus, the superiority of Jesus, when the Bible, you know, these passages tell us that he came to do away with the first. It says he takes away the first that he may establish the second. We have been sanctified through the offering of the body of Christ. And Jesus offered his sacrifice once and forever and sat down at the right hand of God. Of course, he is now our mediator and makes intercession for us. That's something that the priest, Levitical priest, could never do. He was a perfect sacrifice in that he did not have to offer sacrifices for himself first. And through his sacrifice, we have the forgiveness of sin, and that is the true power of the cross. The Jews who lived under the law of Moses, all they could do was follow this animal sacrifice to, and I've heard the term roll their sins forward, but it was what God told them to do, so it was an act of obedience that would allow them to take advantage of the sacrifice that Christ would make later on. But still, it was, there was no forgiveness of sin. Now, when Jesus died upon the cross, and the gospel was preached, people responded to that gospel, then there was an opportunity through obedience, taking advantage of that, to have a person's sins forgiven. Has anybody got any comments to add or anything like that?
From a personal standpoint, when I sin now, I can ask for forgiveness of God immediately, and I can have my conscience clean, knowing that I've repented, prayed to God, and trust that He'll forgive me. In the Old Testament, you have to wait till I'm just thinking consciously, you got to wait until the priest offers, I guess you couldn't have that feeling that I'm okay with God until after that happened. The priest is still, he's constantly doing that, but he's not doing it every second of the day. From a personal standpoint, just mentally thinking, how much better we have it with, Christ as our sacrifice, knowing that, we can go to God in prayer and ask Him anytime we want to, forgive me of something I did, and please give me strength. I would think so much better about it than what they had when they tested.
Right. And I think that really underscores, and I don't want to say that we're guilty of taking prayer for granted, and I'm not saying that, but I wonder sometimes when I think to myself, what power there is as a Christian to be able to approach the throne of God through prayer. The Jews could not do that. The high priest, he went in there once a year to make that intercession, to make that sacrifice for the sins of the people. What power do we have in the gospel that I can go home either tonight or on the way home or some point in the day, I can lift my voice to God and ask Him to be merciful and forgive me for the things that I've done wrong in the day. Now, granted, it's incumbent upon me to repent of those things and not do them anymore, but still, what a wonderful, truly wonderful, amazing thing about the power of the cross that's made possible for us. And another thing, to be able to live the life of a Christian and approach death, I would venture to say that we as Christians approach death, or can approach death, in much, I hesitate to use the word better way, but it's the only word I can think of.
Well, we're able to approach it with hope.
Right. Whereas if you died as a Jew, you had to hope that Jesus would come, that the Messiah would come.
And have followed all the traditions leading up to that.
Right. We, now through faith, we believe that Jesus was who He said He was, being the Son of God, and that He is able to do the things that He has promised to His children. And I just think it's a wonderful confidence to have. Yeah.
Mark, I think it's very similar to what we were talking about on Sunday morning in our Bible classes, is that now Jesus has brought forth something that's spiritual for us. The parallel that I thought about was Colossians chapter 2, verse 16, not to get into this huge, huge discourse, but it seems to fit that, where it talks about verse 16, "Let no man therefore judge you in meat or in drink or in respect of holy day or the new moon or the Sabbath days." Well, what's he talking about there? Well, all these different things then that they had to do as Jews. Verse 17, "Which are a shadow of things to come, but the body is of Christ." We've got it. We don't have to do these rituals and these routines and these things. We have pure, final, as we see sometimes here, unadulterated ability to come before God's throne being in Jesus Christ, where they never had that opportunity to do that
before. I think in a word, that's liberty. True liberty.
Yeah.
We do not have to, and God could have easily said, once a year you have to travel to Jerusalem. He could have, he wanted to. And faithful children would have done that. But, you know, when Jesus was talking to the Samaritan woman, and he said that the day is coming when they will worship God in spirit and truth, and you won't worship him on this mountain, but, you know, you'll worship God in spirit and truth. That freed man from being locked to a geography. And, you know, we now, though we're thousands of miles away from Jerusalem, we can still worship God just as well as anybody who's standing in Jerusalem right now could. So that it's, you know, it's liberty. Yes.
Do you think that the people under the old law, especially, I mean, back when they were making the sacrifices, really understood that, because it hadn't all been revealed yet? And he's explaining to these people why they don't have to go back and still do all that.
Right.
These people didn't even understand. So do you think that when they were actually making all those sacrifices, they understood what they had to look forward to?
Well, of course, these people had been, I don't know how many, I'm going to say that the gospel has been preached at least over 30 years at that point. So how much they really understood?
What I mean is the people back hundreds of years.
Oh, no, because I think, I mean, it was it's often referred to as a mystery. And,
yeah.
You know, so no, if I had to answer that based on my own thought, I would say, you know, they probably didn't have the complete understanding.
Death really couldn't have been comforting at all.
Well, now you have a good point there. Consider that. Well, anybody have anything additional to say there for that?
I just think that, you know, there's a more of a discourse, I think, in what Lori's talking about in Acts chapter 1, if you go anything about what they actually, you know, did know. But there was definitely a lot that they didn't know. That was the whole, I think, purpose of the lesson in Acts chapter 1 and Acts chapter 2 is, let me tell you what you don't know.
Right. Now, they were given glimpses because the prophets, correct, like Isaiah. And I don't know, off the top of my head, I don't know exactly when Isaiah came on the scene. But, yeah.
Well, and I continue with that theme, Mark. You're right. The Messiah would come. There's the promise of the Messiah, and he's going to bring forth salvation. But it's not like the promised land that here it is. You know, they still had to do something for the promised land. They're still going to have to do something to receive salvation and be in Jesus Christ. And so that part of it then is revealed in Acts chapter 1 and Acts chapter 2 of the next steps that they need to do. So they know the Messiah is going to come. But even as we read in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John, especially in John, those apostles don't get it then. His disciples don't get it then. They're still thinking physical.
But one thing, now, in God's dealing with the children of Israel, one thing that he tried to instill in them was for them to have faith in his ability to deliver them.
Yeah.
And I think that would have been, whether they had complete knowledge in what God's ultimate plan was, that maybe yes, maybe no. But one thing that they were taught from Abraham forward, trust in the Lord, and he will take care of you. Has that not been their whole experience with God?
Well, that's where you're about to get here in another chapter or two in Hebrews is what's leading up to that.
Right. Tim.
You know, to say that even the gospel, they're still looking for an earthly king.
Right.
You know,
right.
If Christ comes, they're still, you know, when are you going to set up your kingdom? So they're still looking for the physical, you know, the spiritual, it just hasn't connected with the two. I mean, we have hindsight, right?
Exactly. I was just going to say, we're basically the Monday morning quarterbacks of Christianity, because we can sit here and we know, we can look all the way back to Adam and come forward based on what God revealed to us, and we can see these things. And I don't think for a minute that I'm any greater intellect than any of them. Who's to say that I might not have been in the same circumstances, not understanding, but they would eventually come to understand. At least, especially the apostles, they really would understand, and then they would be charged with doing that and trying to teach others that. Okay, go ahead, and I think we're ready for verse 19. I would like to do 19 through 25. Where are we left off?
Therefore, brothers, since we have confidence to enter the holy place by the blood of Jesus, by the new and living way that he opened for us through the curtain, that is, through his blood, and since we have a great priest over the house of God, let us draw near to the true heart in full assurance of faith, with our hearts sprinkled clean from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with blood. Let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering. For he who promised is faithful, and let us consider one another in order to stir up love and good works, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together as in manner of some, but exhorting one another, and so much the more as you see the day approaching.
Now, we talked about that a moment ago, holding fast that confession of our hope. And that was the writer's admonition, trying to get them to, you know, to hold on to what they believe, what they've been taught. And, you know, we were talking a moment ago about knowledge and knowing and not knowing. And, you know, the old law has been referred to as a shadow. And I think when you think about that, when you think of that in that terms, wasn't, you know, there was a lot of things not understood. But again, you know, as we talked about a minute ago, you know, at some point, we're not going to understand everything. God's already told us our ways are, his ways are higher than our ways. His understanding is greater than ours. And there are just certain things, and I know that I wrestle with about mankind and the judgment. And the vast majority of humankind is going to be lost. That is hard to wrap your mind around. And you just, you know, it's just, to me, it's just, you know, those are the kind of, there are other things that, you know, each of us may have things that we wonder about, that we struggle to understand. And it's, you know, the limitations of the human mind. And at the end of the day, we're just human beings. I don't care if you could be a Nobel laureate, but at the end of the day, you're just a human being. And you are limited. You may be less limited than some of the rest than the average person, but we're still limited in our ability to comprehend. Well, okay, the next point that I have is, what is the end quotes, to sprinkle from an evil conscience in reference to?
Before you go there, can I come back to that?
Sure.
So having the boldness to enter the holiest, that's us being able to enter the holiest place where the high priest was only allowed to enter once a year, right?
Right.
And that holiest place is heaven?
Well, now, I could be wrong, but I look at that as being the power of prayer,
okay.
In that, okay. we can go to God directly. Now, we're not going to step into heaven to do it,
right.
But our prayers are
immediate access.
Right,
okay.
Immediate access, exactly. Okay. And I don't have to, let's just say for argument's sake, now we already said it was the 7th month, the 10th day of the 7th month. Well, let's just say that that's what that was, you know. Then, you know, the 11th day of the 7th month, you have another year before the high priest goes into the holiest of holies. We don't have that limitation. We can approach God anytime, anywhere, day or night. That is power. Yes.
That was symbolic when the veil was ripped from top to bottom, separating all that.
Right. just you know, totally removed.
And with us being priests and Jesus being the high priest, that's how we
can. But now, you would be surprised. I just wonder how many people in the religious world realize that we are priests. There's not a clergy-laity relationship in the church.
They couldn't grasp that we're saints either.
Well, true. But, you know, those things are synonymous with just rank and file Christian. There's nothing wrong. So as soon as this thing gets back to where it's supposed to be,
Mark, I think another passage that's similar to what Lori's talking about is Ephesians chapter 2, verse 18. And it says, "For through him we both have access by one Spirit unto the Father." And then it goes on also in verse 21, "In whom all the building fitly framed together groweth into a holy temple in the Lord." And so, you know, reminding us, we have access. We also have responsibility.
And it makes you wonder what that Jew was going through, that Jew, the Jewish people's minds. This appeal is being made to them. They're having to say, they're having to reason it out in their own mind about the practice of the law and then the liberty of Christ. And it's, to me, again, you know, setting back over 2,000 years later, seems to me like it's a pretty easy choice to make. But, yes, ma'am.
So, kind of like what people have been saying, I guess verse 22 makes it clear that it's not anybody that can go and approach God. It's those who have been baptized and are faithful, because it talks about, you know, your conscience has to be, you know, clean. And even the priests, they had to make sure that they were, you know, they did their part before they were able to. Like, they had to clean themselves and, you know, put on the right robe. So we still have to make sure, you know, that we've been baptized and we're still trying to live before. It's not just like
traditional. Well, I mean, that avenue is open to the Christian. You know, as, you know, if you want to talk about, you know, in the under law, that was reserved exclusively for the high priest. Well, this now is reserved exclusively for the Christian. Okay. What allows us to hold fast the confession of our faith without wavering? I'm not the best question asker, but when I was stumbling, it popped in my head, it really made sense to me. But the answer that I was looking for, the fact that his promises are faithful. Yeah. And that's how we can hold fast, you know, the confession of our faith without wavering, because we know, at least based on the faith that we have in this Bible, that God does what he says he's going to do. And not only he does it, but he easily has the ability to do that. And I'm not sure of very many things in this world, but I have total confidence in God's power. I just do. I think about the events that we, you know, about the people that have become sick. And I know that we talk about praying for them, and I know that we all trust and believe that God is able. Or man is limited, God is unlimited. Yes.
That's where faith comes in.
Absolutely.
I mean, unwavering faith.
Absolutely.
If you don't have that, then that's where a lot of people fall.
And, you know, when I think about faith, my mind, I always think about when the children of Israel were ready to go into the land, and spies came back, and that has made an impression on my mind. And whenever I feel a little, maybe like, I don't know how to describe it, whenever I feel like that maybe I'm not as trusting in God as I should be, think about that. Think about, you know, Joshua and Caleb. God was able to do for Caleb as an old man up in the mountains fighting to take what God said he would have, and he had. He wasn't constrained. because God willed it to be so. And so that's, you know, that's where the confidence I get in just events like that. And there are many events like that throughout the history of the Bible where God always carries the day. He's just undefeated.
Sometimes he just carries you in.
Right. That's right. Just just God is, what God has done to the world, like you said, with just a handhold, you know, that he had sent us to do things that he wanted to accomplish, all those things. And we're not talking about things that happened over a period of 20 or 50 years. We're talking about things that happened over thousands of years. A God who could carefully construct a plan and see that plan through over thousands of years. That's, to me, that's amazing.
Well, knowing that, you know, God is the same regardless of the circumstances. You think about what happened in Oklahoma, you know, this week. From that same event, there are probably people that are cursing God, and there are people that are praising God. It depends on which side of the spectrum that you're on. But knowing that God is always the same, no matter which situation you find yourself in, he's there. And if he's not there for you, it's not his fault, it's your fault.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned that. I was watching the news, and it actually brought tears to my eyes to hear these people, because they interviewed about four or five people, and they all were just thanking God for sparing them. And, you know, their attitudes were wonderful. You know, when you're sitting there looking over the ruins of your home, and you're thanking God that you're alive, and you know, one guy said, you know, we'll salvage what we can, and we'll rebuild. And, you know, he was just, they were just, you know, they just really were, you know, just grateful to God to be alive, and that things weren't as bad as they could have been. And I don't know how I would react in a circumstance like that. I hope and pray I never have to find out. But if I do, I hope that's my attitude. I think about Job. You can't help but think about Job in times like that. Okay, and how do we stir up love and good works?
Encouraging one another.
Right. But in the passage that we read, verse 25, we're doing it right now.
I was going to say, by letting other people know how much you appreciate the things that they do for you, you know, the things that you, or whether they're doing them, you know, specifically for you, but just, you know, telling you to pray, come and set up the sign, and just things that people do that you take for granted sometimes. I think letting everybody know your appreciation for a card or something, you know, a prayer, somebody mentions you in a prayer, or, you know, whatever, that you let each other know how much you appreciate that. And then that way we can stir that up with each other, that, you know, each of us should feel the same way, that I want to do something good. If everybody's striving to do something good for everybody else, then nobody's looking at themselves and trying to do things for themselves. You know, everybody else is looking out for each other. And that's what we see in the early church, you know, in Acts 2. They all got together, whatever anybody needed, they threw it all together, and whoever needed it took it, and they didn't worry about who it was to begin with.
And I know I've said this before, and I'll probably say it many more times. In the time since we began meeting in Warren and Tina's house when we first started, I've never felt more aligned and more attached to the church. Now, don't get me wrong, the years we spent worshiping out Northwest were wonderful. And those of us who were there probably had the same feeling. But I don't think we achieved the level of closeness out there as we have with this group. And it's special and it's fragile. And it's something that requires all of us to nurture and treat it, as it is fragile. Because this is a local church, and we may be small in number, but again, it's always a small. God always accomplished great things.
Strength in numbers.
small numbers. So that's irrelevant. What's important is that the close ties that we build here, and the, you know, what our goal is first to love each other and to serve God faithfully, and try as best as we can to try to save the preaching of the gospel as many people in this area, because that day is coming. God has it set. I don't know, but I know that there is a time that is appointed that Jesus will return. And then I think about our culture now, how it has decayed to the point where Jesus and God are mocked, and made light of, and they poke fun of. But I know it, you know, in my heart. And I'm not wishing for this, because when that day gets here, there's no more second chances. That's all over. But I know that God has the power to turn the laughter to tears. And I want to do everything in my power to serve Him faithfully, encourage my children and my family to serve Him faithfully, so we can approach, as we each take our turn to speak, we can approach Him with confidence. As much confidence as I can muster. I have no, you know, it's going to be a great, awesome, and terrible day. So, back to the point we're trying to make, this local congregation, by our assembling together, we build each other up. We help each other not to lose focus on what we're going. We're going to the throne of God. And that's a wonderful, wonderful thought to have. But we've got to take care of the stuff that we're entrusted with right now. And serve God. Yes.
I think part of what he's trying to point out is that there is no better spiritual boost than when we come together to worship. That's the fellowship that he calls fellowship. When we get together outside, we build great friendships and bonds and that kind of thing, but when we feel the closest to one another is when we are truly in what God calls fellowship, when we come together to worship, or when we come together for Bible study like we do on Friday nights, or when we come together for, like, when the women come together for ladies' Bible class, or when we're studying God's Word and we're in fellowship with Him, that's when we're the absolute closest. And so then when we have experiences like one of us passes away, like those who know Judy Dennison down at Southside, we rely on that. We depend on one another, and that we have hope, and that stirs us all up to keep the faith.
Right. Yeah, I agree. And I think, of course, I'm 50 years old. I don't know. Some of you are thinking, "Oh, I look like you're 60." Okay. But in any event, it seemed like it was, I don't know, last year I was 25. You know, we were sitting around the table the night before church talking about, you know, when Elle and I first met, and, you know, Chelsea and I, we were talking about that. Like, you know, has it really been that long? 21 years ago? And the answer was yes. Yes. And in the blink of an eye, you know, if God wills, another 20 years can come and go really quick. And but I, you know, I have my confidence that regardless of if death comes to me today, 20 years, 30 years, whatever, that I have the confidence that Jesus is going to raise me up. And that's what makes this life bearable, is that wonderful hope.
Were you pointing to me, Mark?
Yes.
I think we're almost out of time, but what I wanted to say is when I've talked to people about this congregation, and I totally agree with what you're saying about the closeness, is I've stated before that it's the smallest, largest congregation I've ever been a part of. Because coming here, I feel like we're a congregation of 100. And I even said that recently to Chuck, and he goes, well, what do you mean by that? And I was trying to explain, you know, about, you know, the closeness and just, you know, the singing and the worshiping together. It just feels like, you know, there's 100 or more of us here to me when we come together and worship. And no doubt then that verse there, it is edifying. It is great. And I think you're right, is that when we're crying or when we're laughing or whatever state we're in, to be able to come to worship, you just know it's the place to be. I don't know how else to describe it.
You know, I'll confess this. I know sometimes I lose sight of that. And times like these are good because there's nothing like making you really focus and getting up here and standing there trying to do something constructive and not look like a babbling idiot. But that's the one thing that I want to try as best I can to guard against, is not letting it become just something I do on Sunday night. Because that's what we do. Because one thing is for sure, I may fool all of you, I will never fool God. So, and the same goes for each and every one of us. Well, we're out of time. Thank you so much for your participation. I think it was a really good class. And I appreciate it.
I wasn't aware. Whatever you do,
do you
want to choose? I think I know. You got it. Yeah.